Welcome to the Personal Computer Show. Today is October the 30th, 2019. I'm Hank Key and my colleague is Joe King. Do you know who has your personal data? Do you know how Facebook, Google, and Amazon and the other big tech companies are using your personal data? Our website is pcradioshow.org. We can be heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time, prn.fm, streaming on the Internet. Podcasts of the program is available on prn.fm on the Internet and pcradioshow.org. To listen to the live program on the telephone each Wednesday at 6 p.m., the number is 641-793-7091. You can leave me a message if you have any questions or comments at hank@pcradioshow.org. In the headlines, Google spies on their own employees. Google is capping free storage and promoting paid cloud subscription for storage. Apple pulls iOS 13.2 after users complain update bricks HomePods. The Internet birth certificate from 50 years ago. Benjamin Rockwell's IT Pro Series segment on backups. What is a quantum computer? How many shopping days there are before Christmas? There will be ads of products at unbelievably insane prices. Marty Winston reporting on consumer electronics for home pets. Before we begin, a brief comment on this day in history 81 years ago. The War of the Worlds broadcast on this day in history, October the 30th, 1938. Today is the anniversary of the War of the Worlds broadcast on this date in history when Orson Welles and his troupe of radio actors interrupted the Columbia Broadcasting System's programming to report that our planet had been invaded. Martians had landed at Grover's Mill in New Jersey. Orson Welles' realistic radio dramatization of a Martian invasion of the Earth was a broadcast on the radio on October the 30th, 1938. Welles was only 23 years old when his Mercury Theater Company decided to update H.G. Wells' 19th century science fiction novel, The War of the Worlds, for national radio. Despite his age, Welles had been in radio for several years, most notably as the voice of The Shadow, in the hit mystery program of the same name. War of the Worlds was not planned as a radio hoax, and Welles had little idea of the havoc it would cause. The show began on Sunday, October the 30th at 8 p.m. A voice announced, "The Columbia Broadcasting System and its affiliated stations presents Orson Welles and the Mercury Theater on the air in War of the Worlds by H.G. Wells." Sunday evening in 1938 was prime time in the golden age of radio, and millions of Americans had their radio turned on. But most of these Americans were listening to ventriloquist Edgar Bergen and his dummy Charlie McCarthy on NBC, and only turned to CBS at 8:12 p.m. after the comedy sketch ended and a little-known singer went on. By then, the story of the Martian invasion was well underway. Welles introduced his radio play with a spoken introduction, followed by an announcer reading a weather report. Then, seemingly abandoning the storyline, the announcer took listeners to the Meridian Room in the Hotel Park Plaza in downtown New York, where you will be entertained by the music of Ramon Raquello and his orchestra. Dance music played for some time, and then the scare began. An announcer broke in to report that Professor Farrell of the Mount Jennings Observatory had detected explosions on the planet Mars. Then the dance music came back on, followed by another interruption in which listeners were informed that a large meteor had crashed into a farmer's field in Grover's Mill, New Jersey. And you thought fake news was something new. We had fake news before any of the current presidential candidates were born. Google spies on their own employees. My opening of each show is, do you know who has your data? Do you know how they are using the data? Big tech has been in the forefront of news on security and privacy. Now we are all in good company. Bloomberg News is reporting Google Inc. employees are accusing the company of trying to spy on them in order to undermine their attempts to organize. Google employees have accused the employer of creating a surveillance tool disguised as a calendar extension designed to monitor gatherings of more than 100 people, a signal that those employees may be planning protests or discussing union organizing. Google parent company Alphabet categorically denies the accusation. Google claims the extension is a harmless internal tool to fight calendar spam. The accusation, outlined in a memo obtained by Bloomberg News, claims severe unethical conduct from high-ranking Google employees, who they say allegedly ordered a team to develop a Chrome browser extension that would be installed on all employee machines and used primarily to monitor internal employee activity. Employees are claiming the tool reports anyone who creates a calendar invite and sends it to more than 100 others, alleging that it is an attempt to crack down on organizing and employee activism. The existence of the in-progress software tool was discovered in September, Bloomberg News reported, after employees on the privacy review team flagged it over concerns with how it squared with company culture. Later in October, employees began discussing the tool with others, learning it would be forcibly installed on company machines and would not be removable. The surveillance tool earned even more scrutiny after some employees were barred from accessing documentation about the project. Alphabet denies the accusations and claims the product has been in the works for months and underwent standard legal, privacy, and security review. These claims about the operation and purpose of this extension are categorically false. This is a pop-up reminder that asks people to be mindful before auto-adding a meeting to the calendars of large numbers of employees, a company spokesman tells Bloomberg. The company also claims the tool does not report identifiable information to Google about employees creating invites and doesn't stop those invites from going out, but is instead designed to help cut down on calendar spam. The relationship between Google leadership and employees has grown increasingly contentious in recent years, following high-profile episodes like the firing of anti-diversity memo author James Damore, the company's stance on controversial government contract work and courting business in China, and last year's massive Google walkout over the company's handling of sexual harassment. Since 2016, employees have slowly nurtured an effective and mobilized activist coalition within Google to better hold leadership accountable and to enact change on a scale previously unheard of in Silicon Valley and in ways that have since been adopted across the tech industry. Earlier this week, Google management in the company's Zurich, Switzerland office tried to shut down an employee-led talk on unionization by canceling the event and offering to host its own discussion on labor laws. But the initial meeting happened anyway. Last month, Google contractors in the company's Pittsburgh office voted to unionize with the Union Steelworkers Union, with the process now moving in the bargaining stage. Inquiring minds want to know, would this extension be made available to interested companies that want to track their own employees? We'll wait and see. Google is capping free storage and promoting paid cloud subscription for storage. Google hooked billions of consumers to its digital services by offering free cloud storage. That's beginning to change. Bloomberg News reports Google is capping free storage and prodding users toward paid cloud subscription called Google One. The cost isn't excessive for most consumers, but at the scale Google operates, this could generate billions of dollars in extra revenue each year for the company. A big driver of this shift is Gmail. Google shook up the email business when Gmail was launched in 2004 with much more free storage than rivals were providing at the time. It boosted the storage cap every couple of years, but in 2013 it stopped and it was capped at 15 gigabytes of free storage. There have been many complaints from users who have hit the cap limit. Google is not cutting free storage, but just capping what is free. The user base had been conditioned to expecting continuous increase in storage access for free. This is not realistic. This should be an alert to the user base of free Google storage that their data should not be dependent on a single site. Although very unlikely, if Google were to go the way of Eastman Kodak with free storage, you would be scrambling now to save the data on very short notice. And is that data really being used or needed? At this point, you have two options if you have reached the cap limit and want to continue with Gmail service. Changing to another email address has proven to be a major logistic problem for many. Adding another Gmail account is no different, as you have to notify all recipients of the new address. The latest build of Windows 10 wants a tether to your email address. Many online services have used your email address for account verification. Many medical records are using your email address to tie the medical data records together. What can you do if you want to continue with Gmail service and not have to contend with a cap on free storage? You can start unloading your email of the many messages that have been retained for reference. The other option is to be a paid subscriber of Gmail service. Google has also extended or limited other promotions recently that gave people free cloud storage and helped them to avoid Gmail crisis. New buyers of Chromebook laptops used to get 100 gigabytes at no charge for 2 years. In May 2019, that was cut to 1 year. Chromebooks have been sold with very little storage capacity. This needs to be changed. Smartphones dramatically increased the number of photos people have taken. One estimate put the total for 2017 at 1.2 trillion images. Those images quickly fill up storage space on handsets, so tech companies including Apple, Amazon, and Google offered cloud storage as an alternative. Each year, new model cell phones have increased the photographic pixel resolution, which means larger file size for pictures taken. Now those online memories are piling up, and some of these companies are charging users to keep them. In May, Google unveiled Google One, a replacement for its Drive cloud storage service. There's a free 15-gigabyte tier, enough room for about 5,000 photos, depending on the resolution. Then it cost $1.99 a month for 100 gigabytes and up from there on. This includes several types of files previously stashed in Google Drive, plus Gmail emails, and photos and videos. The company ended its Chromebook 2-year 100 gigabyte free storage offer around the same time, while the Pixel free photo storage deal ended in October with the release of the Pixel 4. Gmail Drive and Google Photos have more than 1 billion users each, as the company whittles away free storage offers and prompts more people to pay. That creates a potentially huge new revenue stream for the company. If 10% of Gmail users sign up the new $1.99 a month Google One subscription, that would generate almost $2.4 billion a year in annual income of recurring sales for the company. It is time people start to take backup of personal data seriously. The liability of having personal data stored in cloud storage is the data can be accessible to hackers. By the way, it also enables the federal government to easily have access to your data. If they can easily indict a ham sandwich, they can just as easily get a court order to access your data. Apple pulls iOS 13.2 after users complain update bricks HomePods. The HomePod hasn't quite enjoyed the widespread success of competing smart speakers like the Google Home Mini and Amazon Echo, and now things have just gotten worse. Now that Apple's iOS 13.2 patch has reportedly started bricking HomePods. iOS 13.2 and Audio OS, the OS that Apple uses on the HomePod, was released shortly after Apple announced its new AirPods Pro, which prompted many users to update their devices. Unfortunately, following the update, multiple users on social media forums and other places started running into issues with their HomePods. The problem for Apple seems to have multiple layers, because alongside the software updates, Apple Music also went offline temporarily. This caused users to try to unpair or reset their HomePods, only for the HomePod to get stuck in an infinite boot loop, reportedly showing a spinning disc instead of the normal multicolor pattern. Meanwhile, other users reported that simply updating their device to the latest version of AudioOS was enough to make the HomePods unusable. Apple has since pulled all of its recent software to prevent users from updating their devices, and now any attempt to install the update will simply time out. If you've downloaded the update but haven't installed it yet, you want to hold off on it. For Apple users, upgrading the software on your Apple devices shortly after release is becoming an increasingly risky proposition. The Internet Birth Certificate from 50 years ago. 50 years ago, on October the 29th, 1969, the Internet was born. It was a humble beginning, a simple login from a computer terminal at UCLA in Los Angeles to the Stanford Research Institute in the Bay Area. But it was a tiny baby step that would eventually catapult the world into the information age. It is not the Internet as we officially know it, but the precursor to the Internet. ARPANET, which stands for Advanced Research Projects Agency Network. On that very Wednesday, the first ever computer-to-computer link was established. ARPANET was a government project. The United States was in the middle of the Cold War, and threats of a catastrophic event like nuclear attack was feared. The government wanted a way to distribute information in the event that a bomb hit an important computer line. Scientists argued that if there was a way to link computers on a network, other systems could keep running even if others had been destroyed. ARPANET also served as a testbed for new technologies, linking many universities and research centers. The first two nodes that formed the ARPANET was UCLA and Stanford Research Institute, followed shortly thereafter by the University of Utah. Under ARPANET, several major innovations were developed. In 1971, email, the ability to send simple messages to another person across the network. In 1972, Telnet, a remote connection service for controlling a computer. And in 1973, File Transfer Protocol, FTP, which allows information to be sent from one computer to another in bulk. Amazingly, we actually have a piece of paper that documents that important moment for the Internet. The computer terminal operators who were working at UCLA in 1969 kept a detailed logbook of everything that was happening as they set up their network. And in a notebook entry for 29OCT69, which stood for October 29, 1969, we can see a particular important notation at 22:30, that's 10:30 p.m. Pacific time, and in quotes, talk to SRI host to host. That sheet of paper, which currently sits at the archives of UCLA, is more or less the Internet's birth certificate, a written record of that moment when the two host computers at UCLA and SRI started communicating. With Google capping of free data storage and with many small towns and villages under ransomware siege, we are rebroadcasting Benjamin Rockwell's IT Pro Series segment on backups.
Technology in the workplace is all around us. This is Benjamin Rockwell, and now I'm going to put on my work hat, and I'm going to talk about those things that you hear at the office, but you want to know a little bit more information about it. Today, I'm addressing the world of the IT professional and how they work with backups. First, before I go any further, do you do backups? The backup of your data, of our systems, is important beyond most people's comprehension until they've lost something that they simply cannot replace on their computer. A long time ago, I was working on a team. We got a new guy. He came on board, and he talked a really good game. but we started to really wonder about him. I don't know. We were confused. He didn't seem to respond to computer conversations like other team members. And it puzzled us until one day, about 3 weeks later, this particular team member was assigned to back up the servers, and he went off to do his job. Many hours later, computer users were freaking out. They were calling about their files going missing, and after some research, we found out that in setting up the backup, that team member had checked a crucial box that said, back up the files, then delete them. Yep, that's right. That's just like the tape on Mission Impossible. Good luck, Jim. This message will self-destruct in 5 seconds. What? Wait a second. In the personal world, that would be a disaster. Okay, actually, in the professional world, it's a near disaster as well. We had roughly 300 people that were without access to their data for over a day. Yes, that takes a while to recover. That's 300 people that lost a work day. I'll let you do the math. It's a lot. Fortunately, there are a number of things that we do as technology professionals to back up the data that is so near and dear to our company, that keeps the company afloat, that without it, well, unemployment and job classified sections would be the near future for many of our coworkers. First, there are multiple backup systems available. In this case, we only had to pull the tape that was just created. We just started running the restore process. Now, sure, there would be a few files that were updated that day that would be gone, but a day's lost work is better than losing all of the data. Next, there are options like multiple tapes. And there are extensive strategies for this. Now, one such strategy is to back up the systems completely once a week. Now, you then do a backup every night of all of the files that have changed since the last backup of those files. You then keep each of those daily backups for the entire week, and then combined with a weekly backup, you've got everything for the week. At any point in time, you can go back and just restore anything. You then keep that one weekly backup from the end or the beginning of the month. So now you have a monthly backup, a weekly backup for everything that month, and then the daily backups as well. Stack one more on there, and you keep one backup each year, usually coinciding with your fiscal year. You then reuse any of those tapes when that particular individual backup is no longer needed. That would be all of them except for the annual backup. So ideally, you always have the January 1st of every year, the 1st of every month, the 1st of every week, and one for every day this week. That's a lot of tapes. But there's other options too. One option is a special server that works as a disaster recovery box. What does this do? Well, it keeps all of the data, much like on tapes, but on very special hard drive setups that track and deduplicate the data. Deduplicate. Tricky term. It's kind of what it sounds like. It goes through and it makes sure it's not storing a bunch of the same information over and over and over and over and over again. So in that way, we're compressing it. Now, these hard drive setups compress it even more. It then stores the data in multiple ways, so it would take a complete, total, end-of-the-world style disaster to lose important data. The cloud, the internet, is also one that is out there and is in use by a number of companies. And all of the data in some companies is already completely, fully stored in the cloud. There is a major shifting of responsibility from the local IT guy to places like Amazon or other remote data locations. But fortunately, Amazon and those many companies that handle those remote data locations, they also know the importance of saving data. They keep huge warehouses full of servers that are loaded up with a whole bunch of hard drives, and they set up special systems to keep your data secure. Now, it does mean moving a lot of data over the internet, but now I'm going to go back to the very beginning. I asked you this question at the very beginning, but I'm going to preach it to you one more time. When was your last backup? If the professionals can keep track of backups like this, what are you doing to keep your data, your information, your livelihood, your tax returns, your camera photos, your resume, your business, the many portions of your life? What are you doing to keep it secure? All of those things I've mentioned, those important parts, those pieces of your life are all on your local hard drive. And in a moment, they can be gone, just poof, forever erased. You need to go out, get a backup hard drive, back up all of your data. Don't risk it. I know so many people who have just said, oh, I'll deal with it later. I did that once. I said, I'll deal with it later. And I really was only going to wait a couple of weeks. It just so happened that, yeah, I lost data too. Oh, well. This is Benjamin Rockwell. Back to you, Hank.
Thank you, Benjamin. The future computer of tomorrow with quantum computing. What is a quantum computer? It is a computer which makes use of the quantum states of subatomic particles to store information. How does a quantum computer differ from the computer that we use? Instead of computing using normal bits, they use quantum bits or qubits. A qubit is made up of an electron or the single nucleus of an atom. A quantum computer regulates or changes these quantum systems containing atomic and subatomic particles. The bits being crunched in your laptop are either zeros or ones of a particle. In a quantum computer, a number of elemental particles such as electrons or photons can be used. Google scientists confirm in that their quantum computer had needed just 200 seconds to solve a problem that they claim would take the world's fastest supercomputer 10,000 years to complete. The team first ran the algorithm last spring using a 54-qubit processor called Sycamore. While the achievement is called quantum supremacy, it doesn't mean that quantum computers are suddenly more capable than classical computers. Since Google's quantum computer only beat the competition at a single highly contrived problem. Quantum computers with day-to-day application may still be decades away, but this is an important scientific milestone when comparing quantum computers to their classical counterpart. For such large-scale endeavors, it is a good engineering practice to formulate decisive short-term goals that demonstrate whether designs are going in the right direction. Google's chief scientist of quantum hardware and quantum computing theory had written a post that they had devised an experiment as an important milestone to help answer these questions. Quantum computers are a new kind of computing device that could one day be capable of solving problems that classical computers can't. Instead of a series of transistors linked together, representing two choice bits like in classical computers. Their base unit is the quantum bit or qubit, a piece of hardware that mimics the behavior of a subatomic particle. Qubits communicate via the probability-driven theory of quantum mechanics instead of the regular rule of logic. There's still two choice systems that output binary code, but getting to the answer incorporates the quantum mathematical ideas of entanglement, superposition, and interference. This new architecture may one day excel at simulating the behavior of subatomic particles well enough to create new medicines and new materials. It might also be able to crack the code that modern-day encryption is based on. Scientists must first find a physical system that assumes quantum properties. But quantum states are incredibly fragile. The slightest bump of heat or vibrational energy can make initialized qubits lose their quantumness and turn into regular bits. Google's engineers built theirs looped superconducting wire controlled by quick customized microwave pulses. Google's quantum supremacy experiment essentially sets up random circuits out of these qubits. Certain outputs become more common than others. It's easy for Sycamore to find these outputted strings, But with each new qubit, it would take a regular supercomputer exponentially more time to come up with an answer. Google scientists ran the experiment repeatedly, incorporating a new qubit until the supercomputer simulating the quantum computer couldn't keep up. The main application of such an experiment is that it can produce truly random numbers, something useful in various fields of science, cryptography, art, and of course, online gambling. But a hypothesis called the Church-Turing thesis claims that a theoretical computer called the Turing machine, which basically simplifies all computers to symbols on tape, is the most efficient way to solve computer problems. Google's quantum computer provides evidence against this thesis. Last month, the Financial Times reported that it had found the Google paper describing the completed quantum supremacy experiment on a NASA server, but Google would not confirm the veracity of the report until now. Scientists are debating whether the quantum supremacy experiment actually demonstrated what it claims. The IBM quantum team published a post arguing that a classical computer could more accurately run the Google problem in just 2.5 days. Simply put, it's hard to prove a claim that a classical computer can't do something. This experiment does not mean that quantum computers are suddenly going to appear on your iPhone. There's a lot more of work left to be done. We need to develop the tools to scale up further. Perfecting error correction methods, improving the qubits, and addressing the systems engineering issues that you need to control the platform with thousands or millions of qubits. Tomorrow is Halloween, the first day we start tracking how many shopping days there are before Christmas. There will be ads of products at unbelievably insane prices. I'll turn it over to Marty Winston to tell us where to find these super bargains.
You may have seen the TV commercials where Jay Leno admits to having been the victim of identity theft. We trust Leno, so we believe that it happened. But not everything you encounter in advertising is true. A technologically savvy pal of ours almost got hornswoggled by a pitch for a gizmo that's supposed to cut your energy bills. Never mind the details. What's important here is that if you should click on the link, you get taken to sites that appear to be, in one case, Fox News, and in another, CNN. Only the branding changes. The rest is a glowing fake review of the product. Fake. A fake review. My pal asked me to check it out. That only took a few minutes. First, I did one fast web search of the product name plus CNN, then another with the product name plus Fox News. Each search had zero results. Obviously, those news credentials were entirely counterfeit. Their fake review cited the inventor of this electrical gizmo as a Japanese scientist and Nobel Prize winner. I searched the name. A Japanese scientist with that name had indeed won a Nobel Prize, but there was nothing electrical about it. His prize was in cellular biology. Strike two. That fake review also showed the electric bills for a Los Angeles address dropping from September to October and again from October to November. You don't need a gizmo for that. It just shows that across those particular 3 months, the air conditioning runs less and less often. True for almost everybody. Strike three. The whole thing was bogus, a con job, unsupportable claims and fake citations and counterfeit credentials, and not at all uncommon. You were warned ever since the era of P.T. Barnum when the phrase, "there's a sucker born every minute," was popular. For the record, by the way, there's no evidence that Barnum himself ever said that. And even before that, the Latin phrase, caveat emptor, let the buyer beware, because con men have been around since and even before those ancient times. It took me about 4 minutes total to look into and debunk the ad for that gizmo, and you could check out almost any too-good-to-be-true claim just about as quickly. As a press guy, I know that any proposed product that's panhandling for cash on a crowdfunding site and uses the term first ever is very likely to be dishonest or lazy or ignorant. You think it's a ground floor opportunity to be among the first to own it at a discount? Really? Phooey. It's unlikely to be a treat. It's more likely you've been tricked. Happy Halloween.
Tomorrow's Halloween. This just 29 days before Black Friday. Some of us will wait all year for the Black Friday shopping season. Our heads are filled with the promise of scoring the best price of the year on a new computer, cell phone, television set, tablet, printer, digital camera, or a high-tech gadget, leaving many of us on the fence on buying anything between now and then. But you don't have to be afraid to shop during the spookiest period of the year. Some retailers have already jumped the gun with holiday deals. However, unless you really need it now, just be patient. Take the time to do an inventory of what you have. This will help you identify what you really need versus what is nice to have. Just look at all the things you've purchased still in its original packaging that still has the price tag on it. Make a list of what you want to buy. The economy today for many is doing well, but the rule of thumb I use is your disposable income is about one half of your gross. So do the research. Do a detailed analysis of the specifications of products of interest. List the must-have features and nice-to-have features that you want in the product. Do an analysis of the price trend line of the product during the course of the year. The website CamelCamelCamel.com, which is managed by Amazon, can help you with price tracking a product. You may be surprised that Black Friday and Cyber Monday is not necessarily the best time for a bargain on a specific product. You might end up overpaying if you get taken in by the so-so prices masquerading as fantastic bargains. You can miss out on great deals if you don't do your homework. The trend in low-cost computing equipment in the modern-day notebook or desktop or tablet may have the storage drive and memory soldered onto the circuit board. For most people, replacing the component parts that have been soldered on is not recommended. If the system is from a major manufacturer, many have the maintenance or system manual online for download. There's nothing wrong in buying a non-upgradable system if you have no intention to upgrade the unit at a later date. If that information is not available, call the manufacturer. The technical specifications on many consumer electronic items are very sparse. The printed materials often omit a telephone number to call for assistance. When the original IBM PC was introduced on August 12, 1981, the documentation was very detailed. The circuit diagram and the program listing for the BIOS setup were included. But when the Macintosh was introduced on January 24, 1984, the documentation was notably absent. Steve Jobs' rationale was the system was so intuitive that no documentation was necessary. That, unfortunately, started the industry trend to just include a one-page user guide, if it's available, of little information. The computing industry went from one extreme to the other on product documentation. Operating manuals are no longer packaged with the software. This was followed by online documentation. That has now gotten worse. The online documentation is now just FAQs based on customer questions. A Christmas stocking is an empty sock or sock-shaped bag that is hung on St. Nicholas Day or Christmas Eve so that St. Nicholas can fill it with small toys, candy, fruit, coins, or other small gifts when he arrives. These small items are often referred to as stocking stuffers or stocking fillers. There are many consumer electronic-related items that are typically used as stocking fillers. There are things like flash memory cards, USB flash drives, DVD and CD blank media, and batteries. Some of the typical Christmas stocking fillers do require more attention before purchase. There have been reports of fake SD, micro SD, and flash memory storage being sold to the unexpected public. I was surprised that also flying under the radar are fake solid state drives. Unfortunately, there is a very large market for these items. The fake products may not perform as stated, and capacity size is greatly overstated. There is a true adage. If it sounds too good to be true, it's probably not true. Review the manufacturer's product description on their website, and in the case of SD memory card and lithium battery for a digital camera, stick to the brand name products. Some of these items are white label or white box goods. You may have purchased it because the price was at an insanely low price. You may have taken a chance on its use for a very important event, only to find that you had disappointing results. Unfortunately, there are counterfeits with major brand items on it. Use your common sense. If the price is much lower than the general market price, there is a high chance that the item is not genuine. This is a program I run to test SD, microSD, and USB flash memory before use. With each newly purchased flash memory and card, I format the storage unit before use. I use the program Speedout 0.5 to determine the read and write speed of the storage device. With USB flash drives, you will find no two units of the same model from the same manufacturer to be identical. There is variance on read and write speeds of each drive. I sort them out into different categories. I use high read speed and low write for storing software distribution data, which, once data is written on it, I use it many times for reading. I use the high write speed and low read speed for backing up data, because when I back up, I want to do it in the minimum time. There is a limit on how many writes you can do on a memory storage device. There's a cautionary note on the use of the USB flash drives for backup. The life expectancy of a USB flash drive can be measured by the number of write or erase cycles. USB flash drives can withstand between 10,000 to 100,000 write-erase cycles, depending on the memory technology used. When the limit is reached, some portions of the memory may not function properly, leading to loss of data and corruption. Although I haven't gone into detail on this, unknown or no-name replacement batteries for cameras and notebooks are notoriously overrated. There's a program I use to test notebook batteries. HW Info 32 for Windows 32 operating systems and HW Info 64 for Windows 64 operating systems. I use this program to identify the wear factor of the battery. In general, notebook batteries over time do run down and will not be able to hold its original capacity. This is referred to as the wear factor. When the wear factor exceeds 25%, I start looking for replacement. The wear factor affects the uptime use of the notebook on battery support. Then you have the gray market. Some of the goods are genuine due to oversupply, but not supported by the manufacturer. Manufacturers do have products that don't pass inspection, but somehow they do slip into the gray market. In summation, counterfeits are flooding the market. Buy from reputable dealers or from trusted resellers. Use your common sense. If the price is so much lower than the general market price, there's a high chance that it's not genuine. The consumer electronics bargain of today will be cheaper tomorrow. Just be aware that it's caveat emptor. Marty Winston reporting on consumer electronics for home pets.
I don't think we've ever had a dog who wouldn't jump up, run to the front door, and go into a barking frenzy any time the doorbell rang or any time there was a knock at the door. You know, I just wrote to a company, and this is the honest-to-goodness truth, a company that sells a variety of dog whistles, to ask them if they might maybe be able to come up with one that sounds like a doorbell. And what dog or cat doesn't come running when it hears the sound of an electric can opener? There's very little barking or meowing, but there's a whole bunch of rapt attention. You might argue that doorbells and electric can openers qualify as tech for pets, and that's my subject today, but I want to explore some of the ways that tech can help pets stay safer and owners stay saner. Let's start with runaway dogs. And I want to begin by saying there's one low-tech measure and one high-tech measure that I strongly endorse. The low-tech measure is a tag, or several, with the animal's name, your phone number, and maybe your address. The high-tech companion to that is an implanted RFID chip. And those chips have some other roles to play that I find really useful. I'll get into those in a few minutes. There's a category with a lot of variations of virtual fence products that can help discourage your dog from leaving your yard. With each of them, the dog wears a special collar with an electronics pod on it. That pod has a radio receiver and the ability to issue first a gentle warning tone, then second, a more assertive tone and maybe a vibration, and then third, a small but limited electric shock. I know a lot of people think of them only as shock collars and imagine that it's like a cattle prod. No, they're not. In each case, you establish the borders for the dog's permitted area, but the ways to do that vary. With one of the do-it-yourself products, you position a radio transmitter and set its range, and the dog is okay everywhere inside that circle. With another do-it-yourself product, this one intended for larger properties and larger dogs, there's GPS in the collar. You walk the border of the property or the safe zone, the dog zone, with the collar and with its app, and you can set up as many as 10 different borders. That specific product also includes a tracker that relays the dog's position over a cellular link if it ever leaves its borders. With another do-it-yourself product, you bury a loop of wire to establish a border. If you go that route, I suggest using a 5 to 6 inch blade on a cordless reciprocating saw to create the trench for the buried wire. There's another alternative very much like that, but involving a commercial service that comes out, does the trenching and installation, and trains your dog. The do-it-yourself products tend to be a few hundred dollars each. I've never seen a bid from that commercial service come in under $1,000. The training may help justify some of that. Make no mistake, every one of these alternatives involves somebody getting the dog familiar with its new reality. The do-it-yourself products come with great instructions and some doodads that can help if you want to take on the training yourself. I'm not going to name all of the virtual dog fence products out there. You can find them readily enough, but there's a joke that may help. Where can a dog hide a bone so nobody will ever see it? The answer? On the second page of a Google search. Let me raise one little red flag. You may find other kinds of electronics pods designed for your dog's collar, but not all of them are worth considering. For example, there are some that give you a button to press to discourage the dog from barking. Not always a good thing to do, but let me stick with the tech. Some of them claim to use high-pitched audio or ultrasonics. Some of them use less carefully designed shock collars. I'd like to suggest an alternative or two. First, if your dog is edgy on walks, especially when encountering other people or animals, it may be more about your nature than the dog's nature. Dogs tend to reflect and amplify the edginess of their owners. I found two things that are helpful. One is a dog treat called Edibites. That's E-D-I-B-I-T-E-S, Edibites. These are calming treats that contain CBD. The other is your own behavior. Rather than fearing the worst, that your savage mongrel is about to attack and injure the other dog and its owner, and nervously saying, no, stop, or whatever, you know, while you're tightening your grip on the leash. Instead, speak softly as you approach. Here's a good dog. Come on. Chances are they'll be happy with a sniff. I've also seen, back to the collar, little LED lights that you can clip onto a collar. I'm not sure they're useful, but they won't hurt anything. So if you want your dog to have a headlight for walks in the dark hours, help yourself. I mentioned how helpful those implanted RFID pet chips can be. Let me give you some examples. We have two pets. Buddy is a Jack Russell, and Max is an orange tabby cat. And as any pet owner will tell you, we were lucky enough to get the world's most handsome and intelligent animals. And both are, I'm proud to say, rescues. Now, from their perspective, their favorite tech item is the TV set in the den, because when that turns on, they know they'll get some lap time from mom or dad. Buddy tends to tuck himself under a blanket and fall asleep, unless there's a dog or a horse on the screen. If there is, he jumps down and stands in front of the screen on tiptoes, in his best meerkat pose, sometimes barking a word or two, but mostly, it seems, just waiting to see if that visitor will be coming out of the screen. Now, as you might imagine, when we feed them, each tends to be a little curious about the other's food, and there have been episodes of, shall we say, poaching? But not for a while, because now each one has his own food dish with an electrically activated cover, good for keeping insects out, by the way, But the cover only opens when the right pet is at the right dish because of those chips. We paired each of them to the chips implanted in each of the pets, each bowl, you know, one pet per bowl. And we do let them share the same low-tech, open anybody, no water, no battery, water bowl. The first time I encountered a chip-responsive product several years ago was in a product called SureFlap. That's S-U-R-E-F-L-A-P, SureFlap. It's a locking pet door that installs in a door or in a wall. Like the dishes, you pair it to your pets, so they're the only ones who can get it to unlock, going out or coming in. I've seen some amazing videos of a very determined raccoon trying to defeat it, trying to get through, and failing every time. One nice thing about SureFlap is that you can set curfews. So if there are times when you don't want your pets to use it, it won't unlock for them. It comes in several sizes, and I think it's brilliant. I have one more product I want to mention that deals with a common, even inescapable need that often leads to unintentional injuries. And that nails the issue. It's nails. If you try cutting your dog's nails with anything that has blades, you risk cutting into the quick. Dremel sent their paw control tool, which hides an abrasive disc behind a specially shaped paw hood, making it very hard to get wrong. So it's less like using snips or clippers and more like using an emery board. Not that a careless person still can't overdo it, but that will take a very long time, a more deliberate action, and it won't happen until well beyond the point when the dog's nail grooming is functionally complete. All of this is covered in the manual for those who read manuals, and for those who don't, I strongly recommend that you bring the dog to a professional groomer. Next time, I might talk about lowering overhead, or I might talk about altitude adjustment. Either way, it's all about extending your reach to places up high where tiptoes alone can't quite take you there. Stools and extension poles and ladders, to be sure, but also scaffolds. And yes, there are some out there that can fold flat and don't cost a fortune. Sorry, I won't be talking about anti-gravity boots. That level of tech is still way above my head.
Thank you, Marty. Computer club meetings in the New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut tri-state region. The computer clubs have random access sessions at each of these club meetings. If you have any questions or need technical advice, the club members are more than happy to assist. There is no such thing as a dumb question. All these computer club meetings are open free to the public. The Amateur Computer Group of New Jersey meets November the 1st. Meeting time is 8 p.m., and they meet at the Scotch Plains Rescue Squad at 1916 Bartle Avenue in Scotch Plains, New Jersey. Danbury Area Computer Society has their meeting on November the 5th. Meeting time is 7:30 p.m., and they meet at the Danbury Hackerspace at 158 Main Street in Danbury, Connecticut. The Westchester PC Users Group has their meeting on November the 7th. Meeting time is 7 p.m., and they meet at the Keller Williams Realty, 120 Bloomingdale Road in White Plains, New York. Long Island Macintosh Users Group will be meeting on November the 8th. Meeting time is 7 p.m., and they meet at the Harry J. Scherr Hall, New York Institute of Technology, Old Westbury Campus, out in Old Westbury, New York. The New York Amateur Computer Club meets November the 14th, meeting time is 7 p.m. at NYU Silver Building, room 411, 32 Waverly Place in Manhattan, New York. We hope to see you at one of these meetings, and if you have a computer club meeting you want me to announce on the air, send me a note. My address is hank@pcradioshow.org. Our website is pcradioshow.org. We can be heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on prn.fm, streaming on the Internet. Podcasts of the programs available on prn.fm, on the Internet, and pcradioshow.org. If you have any questions for us, just send us an email addressed to hank@pcradioshow.org. There is no such thing as a stupid question. In the meantime, stay in touch and remember to do regular backups. I'm Hank Key, and on behalf of Joe King and Michael Horowitz, we thank you for listening. Stay safe and healthy, and until we meet again, same time, same station next week.